That was not a decision that was made by the board. It was Dan's desire, and it was all the folks involved realized and agreed this was the right thing to do.
The head of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation steps down to focus on a gas state gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Pebble Mine proposal moves closer to seeking permits.
I do really think that there's a better than even chance that we will submit our permit application sometime later this year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com.
And by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years, from executive and technical placement to medical and office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Executive Director Dan Foskey is stepping down. AHFC's board announced today that Foskey resigned his post. In a statement released to the press, AHFC's board chair Frank Ropel says the resignation was not unexpected and has been accepted. Board Chair Ropel.
It's been a known issue that was just not going to be able to continue. And then with the passage of House Bill 4 and the powerful funding for the development of Alaska Gas Development Corporation, it became very apparent that the gas business was going to require the full-time attention and that we needed to replace Dan. And that was not a decision that was made by the board. It was Dan's desire, and it was all the folks involved realized and agreed this was the right thing to do.
Effective immediately, Brian Butcher, the state's revenue commissioner, has left his position as commissioner and will take Foskey's place. Ropel says Butcher is the perfect choice.
He has a great financial background, which is important to Alaska Housing, and he's a known quantity. He was one of our management leaders, and it just worked out great. So we were very, very happy to have Brian Butcher as our new CEO, and we're very happy that Mr. Foskey is going to have some of the burden lifted in his role as president of AGDC.
Foskey was head of AHFC for 18 years and now serves as president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, a subsidiary of AHFC. Ropel says Foskey is now free to devote his time to backing an in-state natural gas pipeline. The EPA is expected to release its final watershed assessment of the proposed Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay by the end of the year. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some in Alaska's congressional delegation are urging the Pebble Partnership to submit its application. And the longer the company waits, the more frustrated the delegation gets, the very people who could help shepherd the process.
Pebble Partnership CEO John Shively has maintained for years that his company will submit its application soon.
Well, we're still working on that. I do really think that there's a better than even chance that we will submit our permit application sometime later this year.
The EPA should release its final watershed assessment for the mine site in the next couple of months. Shively and the mine's backers fear the EPA could veto the mine outright before the company submits its permit application because of harmful effects to salmon habitat. If it does not, the company could try to win approval with the Army Corps of Engineers. Senator Mark Begich, like the entire Alaska delegation, says the company should have a chance to apply for a permit. The federal government could then rule out the mine, but he says the EPA should not use its authority to prohibit the permit process. Still, he says the Pebble Partnership has gained a competitive advantage by waiting so long.
What I always hear from the industry is we just need to know what these agencies are going to require us to do. Okay? Well, in Pebble's case, you're going to know before you pull the permit. That's not a bad position if you're a mining company, because now you have an option to say, okay, now I know what they're going to require me to do. Does that meet our economic ability? You know, can we do it?
The Pebble Mine could be one of the world's largest. Developers hope to extract gold, copper, and molybdenum. The Pebble Partnership likes to tout the copper for future renewable energy projects. But opponents of the mine, including many local tribal governments and the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, worry it will destroy the salmon habitat crucial to both commercial and subsistence fishing. They petitioned the EPA to veto the mine using its so-called 404C authority. Its draft watershed assessment says the mine would destroy dozens of miles of streams. Wayne Nastri reviewed the assessment for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation.
And I found that its conclusions are sound and, if anything, conservative.
Nastri was a regional administrator for the EPA during the George W. Bush administration. He's now a consultant for BBNC and has worked with Trout Unlimited in the past.
The watershed assessment identifies significant adverse impacts to the fishery and is a key trigger for 404C action. EPA has the opportunity provide clarity and certainty to those who live and work in the Bristol Bay region by initiating such action.
Certainty is something that everyone wants, from local fishermen to the legislators in D.C. Senator Lisa Murkowski fired off a letter to Shively last month, telling him to hurry up, that it's in his company's best interest to submit its application. She does not say if she thinks the mine is a good investment.
When you think about development of Alaska's resources, our oil resources up north, our fisheries, our timber, I think we can look historically to some actions and development proposals that we're not exactly proud of within our state.
She ticks off a list: near decimated fisheries, clear cutting in the Tongass National Forest, legacy wells in the NPRA.
There may have been a time when you could not build a dam, tailings pond, like Pebble is talking about, without it impacting the watershed. I happen to believe that we're pretty smart nowadays. Our technologies have come a long ways.
The mine would be on state land, and that's where Don Young comes in. To Alaska's lone congressman, the issue is not about fish or metals or money. It's about state rights.
If EPA comes in with this decision, says the mine can't develop on state land, we have lost our state totally. There'll be nothing done in that state. No more mining, no more drilling, no more nothing. There'll be lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit.
Young says both the mine and fishery can thrive as economic engines to one of the poorest regions of Alaska. There are some 14,000 fishermen in Bristol Bay.
I think they can coexist. I know it's an amazing thing. People say they can't. That's wrong. I believe this very strongly, that if you look at the Copper River King, why do they call it the Copper River King?
He answers his own question: because of copper. He says mining near Cordova never disrupted the King Salmon runs on the Copper River. Pebble CEO John Shively says he's hoping to meet with the new EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy, to make his pitch. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has issued an emergency order that will restrict hunters to harvesting Nelchina caribou bulls for most of the upcoming season in Game Management Unit 13. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports from Valdez, the low number of cows was a factor in the decision.
Hunters will have only one day this season to hunt for both bulls and cows in Unit 13. According to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, there is a low number of cows in the unit following this summer's preliminary count. Only 300 cows are included in this season's harvest quota of 2,500. Becky Schwanke is the Glen Allen area biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
We try to figure out just how many days we can go before we have to address the quotas. And with only 300 cows being available for the annual Nelchina herd quota, we expect a fairly large number to be taken basically on the first day, which is a Saturday. So it kind of is compounded by the number of hunters as well as the day that it opens.
Schwanke cites an unanticipated high mortality rate over the winter as one of the reasons for the reduced quota.
We had a pretty obvious late winter, late spring, late green up, and caribou ended up having a lot higher mortality because of it. We also ended up having a lot lower calf numbers during our summer composition survey that we did the day of our census.
The mortality rate for cows last winter was 22%, which is higher than previous years. The mortality rate for bulls was 29%. Alaska Fish and Game's summer preliminary count was an estimated 35,500 caribou. That's down from the 44,000 from the fall 2012 count. Schwanke says an additional 5,000 animals were also counted.
We are counting those animals in with our harvest strategy this year, and we're going to try to offer some additional hunting opportunity because of those additional animals.
The one-day hunt for either bulls or cows will begin on Saturday, August 10th. The emergency order takes effect at 12:01 a.m. on Sunday, August 11th. The season will last until the quota is met. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book explores the lives of those who make their living outdoors.
There were so many shrews that when he'd crawl in his sleeping bag, he'd roll over a couple of them and two more would drop from the edge of the tent onto his head.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
I'm Matt Nuska. Susitna Borough Assembly member is criticizing the borough mayor's communication with the state redistricting board. SKSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports the matter made sparks fly at last night's assembly meeting.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough Assembly met Tuesday at the Palmer Railroad Depot. At the top of the agenda, a resolution sponsored by Assemblyman Warren Kehoe of Chicoloon requesting that Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss' June email to the state's redistricting board be rescinded. DeVilbiss' communication to the redistricting board was in support of the board's current voting map. But Kehoe says the mayor's email was sent without assembly scrutiny or approval, and he says that it flaunts the public process.
Well, this is a resolution that I've brought forward because the mayor is out of bounds. He's making unauthorized communications to, in this case, the state redistricting board. We have a strong manager, weak mayor form of government. It's when he does stuff like this, he didn't write it on letterhead. He sent it from his personal email address. Or the majority of the assembly didn't know anything about it. Steve Culligan knew about it because he gave him the maps. The manager, the clerk, the attorney, the mayor's secretary, nobody knows about this stuff.
Assemblymember Steve Culligan's business provided the map that the mayor referred to in his response to the redistricting board. Mayor DeVilbiss arrived at the meeting armed with another letter he had written explaining that he had been contacted by a redistricting board staffer for his opinion on the voting map and that he had asked for assembly input at an earlier meeting and gotten none. But Kehoe was not buying that excuse. Kehoe said that the mayor's comments to the redistricting board were taken as official ones, and that it is an example of the borough's lack of transparency when it comes to administration affairs. But Kehoe's resolution was immediately dropped from the agenda when Assemblyman Steve Culligan threw a 14-point document on the table outlining all the reasons the assembly should support the mayor's communication with the redistricting board. That document was accepted by the assembly. Culligan's move ultimately ended debate on the unofficial communications issue, but it did not derail a testy exchange between Kehoe and Culligan.
To drop this in our lap without any notice, this is the public process gone completely south.
Assemblymember Culligan.
Number one, I appreciate the drama, but the reality is, Mr. Kehoe, you wouldn't have been able to compile your other comments without looking at the map and the other data. The mayor clearly stated in public record that he was speaking on his own behalf. I'd ask members to urge their support. The boundaries, I think, represent the borough well.
The issue may be moot or not, since the state redistricting board approved the current voting map in July. The map extends the Matsu voting districts north and south, north along the Richardson Highway, and south to include Chugiak, areas that mainly vote Republican. The new map is one supported by the Alaskans for Fair and Equitable Redistricting, a group headed by a former Republican Party of Alaska chairman. If the map stands after a current court challenge, it would provide for a third state senator from the Matsu. The current voting map faces litigation filed by two Fairbanks men who claim that the new Matsu lines do not meet requirements for social and economic integration. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The state has issued a best interest finding on a right-of-way lease application for a gas line to feed a North Slope LNG plant. The Department of Natural Resources Commissioner's analysis and proposed decision is for Spectrum Energy's 1,100-foot gas line. Public can weigh in on the proposal, the lease proposal, until September 3rd. Tulsa-based Spectrum and Fairbanks Natural Gas have both applied for North Slope Gas Line right-of-ways to feed plants to provide LNG for trucking south to Fairbanks and other communities. DNR State Pipeline Coordinator's Office spokesman Graham Smith says the FNG application, which is for a 3.5-mile pipeline corridor, is still pending. ADA spokesman Karsten Rodvik says the state corporation is reviewing LNG proposals from Golden Valley, Spectrum, FNG, and the Fairbanks North Star Borough's Interior Gas Utility.
ADA is in the due diligence phase of the project right now, and we are developing the business structure.
Rodvik says the business model has to meet specific criteria, including getting gas to Fairbanks by the fourth quarter of 2015 and delivering it at a price equivalent to between $1.88 and $2.28 per gallon for heating oil. The centerpiece of the $300 million project is a $200 million North Slope gas processing plant. Rodvik says it's unclear whether one or several of the four interested entities will be needed.
The project needs an estimated $33 million from the private sector or private investment. And however we can best structure that, whether it involves a combination of entities, is what we will do if that becomes necessary.
Rodvik says a report on the four proposals being considered will be delivered to the joint ADA-Alaska Energy Authority Board in October, but no date has been set for selection of a partner or partners. Hot, dry, windy weather has caused growth of three big interior wildfires. The Crater Lake fire near the Yukon Flats village of Venati swelled by more than 850 acres. The human-caused fire has burned more than 1,500 acres since it started on Sunday. Water scooping planes are working the blaze with 104 firefighters deployed on the ground. An Alaska Interagency Coordination Center update says the fire suppression strategy has switched from extinguishing the fire to halting its progress to the east, saying the fire is burning in a bowl with squirrely winds and negligible features for anchoring and safely inserting crews. Meanwhile, the long-burning Moon Lake fire near Tok showed major growth to the north, away from populated areas. The lightning-caused fire, which started on June 26th, has gained 1,300 acres to more than 21,000 total. 93 people are working that fire. Another fire that's been active since being started by a June lightning strike is also gaining acreage. The Toklat River East fire in Denali National Park is now 29,000 acres. This morning's AICC update says four smoke jumpers continue to secure structures and prep fuels for possible burnout operations, adding that Chinook winds have contributed to fire behavior and falling trees.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Flights to and from Alaska were among those affected by a recent international computer system breakdown. Alaska Airlines reports about 50 planes were delayed Monday night, including 10 out of Anchorage and one from Ketchikan. United, American, and Delta were among other affected airlines serving the state. Delays were caused by a breakdown in the Sabre computer reservation system used by more than 300 airlines worldwide. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld spoke to Alaska Airlines' Bobby Egan about the impacts.
We were out for a little over 2 hours. And during that time, many of our flights took delays, given that our employees had to manually check in passengers back like we did in the good old days. It's pretty rare when it does happen, and something like this certainly had a huge impact on us.
The delays began around 7:45 p.m. Monday, Alaska time. Flights in the air were not affected. The Arctic ice cap reached a new low a year ago. In just 6 months, 4.5 million square miles of Arctic Ocean ice melted, according to a 2012 report by the United Nations. While that may be hard to imagine, the commanding officer of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Polar Star says Arctic ice was the lowest he's ever seen in all his ice-breaking trips to the region. After 3 years in a shipyard and a $90 million makeover, the Coast Guard's heavy icebreaker just returned from trials in the Beaufort Sea and made a brief stop in Juneau. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander toured the ship.
It's capable of breaking over 21 feet of solid ice with a 1¾-inch thick steel hull.
Petty Officer Brian Carr has experienced some of the icebreaking capabilities of the Polar Star. He is one of the 150 crew members and officers aboard the rebuilt icebreaker, 115 of them making their first trip to the Arctic. Their commanding officer has spent much of his 30 years in the Coast Guard breaking ice.
Pretty much the most fun job on the planet.
Captain George Palacir started his Coast Guard career as a naval engineer.
We pretty much get to live the Discovery Channel. I mean, where they send us and where we get to go, most people only get to see watching TV or reading about it in a magazine.
That includes deployments to both the Arctic and the Antarctic. It's a toss-up as to which Palacir likes best, though the trip south from the Polar Star's Seattle home port is more diverse, such as crossing the tropics.
Pulling an icebreaker into, say, Tahiti is always interesting.
Penguins greet the ship at the South Pole, polar bears and walrus at the north.
Even the ice that you're actually going through is a little bit different.
On this shakedown trip to the Arctic, the Polar Star found heavier ice than Palacir anticipated.
What we found was all essentially first-year ice where we went, although in the vicinity of Barrow it was all rafted together and piled on top of each other, so it was fairly tough ice.
The ship reached Barrow's ice-choked shore on July 2nd.
We did find that a couple weeks into the trip, the ice was breaking up and receding rapidly. So this trip, there was less ice that we encountered than I've seen in trips past.
The Polar Star spent most of the time in the Beaufort Sea, reaching 78 degrees north latitude.
Not terribly far, but enough to find some nice good ice to play around in for a while and do all our testing.
The rafted ice is some of the hardest to break, a good test for the ship's rebuilt engine, propeller, and navigation systems. The propellers are driven by a diesel-electric or gas turbine power plant. The diesel generators are capable of 18,000 horsepower, and the three turbines, more than 75,000. The thickness of the ice determines which system to use. Palacir gets a real twinkle in his eye when he talks about testing his new ship on the piled-up ice.
We kind of tested the full power by nosing up to a large pressure ridge and, you know, running the turbines one at a time and just running them all the way up through the whole horsepower range, which was kind of neat.
So what does it feel like when the 13,000-ton Polar Star is breaking a mound of ice?
We are one of the few ships on the planet that intentionally run into things. It, you know, makes a fair bit of noise and everything shakes.
The entire ship is an icebreaker. And the trials also tested the Polar Star crew, some fresh out of basic training.
You'll be going through the ice and making good progress. If you hit a pressure ridge or a little bit of thicker ice, all of a sudden the ship will lurch off to one side or the other with, you know, not a lot of warning for the folks. So they learn right quick to close or latch open the doors and to hold on.
Palacir says backing up in the ice is one of the more dangerous things to do. The ship draws 31 feet. The propellers are 16 feet in diameter and sit about 15 feet below the waterline.
You know, the spinning propeller will kind of knock the pieces of ice aside. You'll feel it. It's what we call milling ice. And it does feel like all of a sudden your ship's become a giant blender.
The bigger concern is the rudder. So the key, he says, is taking it slow to make sure the rudder remains centered.
so that it's, you know, going directly back into the ice and not getting knocked over to the side and potentially wedged over to the side.
He says backing up is always a little bit tense.
You just take it nice and slow for the back, and then you get a running start at the ice again.
The newly rebuilt Polar Star is the only operating heavy icebreaker in the Coast Guard fleet. Palliser says the Arctic ice trials show she's a better icebreaker now than when commissioned in 1976. He has a list of work to be done in Homeport, then the ship will head south to Antarctica in about 4 months. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
A new book explores the life many come to Alaska for, but few actually live out. Alaska Tracks shares the tales of hunters, fishermen, and trappers. KUAC's Dan Bross has more.
Alaska Tracks is a compilation of stories put together by longtime Alaska Trappers Association member Randy Zarnke of Fairbanks. Zarnke has spent the last 15 years interviewing Alaska old-timers.
Mid-60s or older, and kind of widely recognized as an effective and ethical hunter, fisher, trapper, or that sort of thing. And then they just love to talk about their experiences and their life in the outdoors, stranded by weather and living with very little food and, you know, lots of really harsh conditions and challenging adventures.
Zarnke's book taps 30 people from 8 regions of Alaska who share everything from life and death to less serious stories, like Fairbanks trapper Ron Long's account of camping during a big shrew year.
There were so many shrews that when he'd crawl in his sleeping bag, he'd roll over a couple of them and two more would drop from the edge of the tent onto his head.
Zarnke, who records all the interviews he does, includes colorful quotes from his subjects, like Earl Callahan's description of a bear run-in.
He said, "Little did that bear know that I could have given him 360 grains of that 375 H&H right between the cookhouse and the bunkhouse," which was his way of saying he could have shot the bear.
Zarnke says there's a common feeling among everyone in his book.
Each one of these people, whether they are wealthy or poor, look back and realize that they led the life that so many people in this world wish they could have, and they value those experiences in the outdoors.
Zarnke says the number of people living on the land is diminishing, and he hopes Alaska Tracks encourages people to get out and try. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.